I'm very happy now to welcome Kyle Dickman. He's contributing editor at Outside Magazine. He's a former hotshot firefighter, and he's author of the new book, On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Thursday, the 23rd of July at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So this is the story of the tragic wildfire in Arizona in the summer of 2013, in which 19 firefighters, the Granite Mountain Hotshots, lost their lives. Many of our listeners have heard about this. And it's a book about so much more, beautifully written book. I mean, you cover firefighter culture, the nature and ecology of fire. First of all, what is a hotshot firefighter as opposed to any other firefighter?
Right. So hotshot firefighters tend to be 20-person crews. They're most people consider them elite teams, and their job is to travel anywhere around the country, and they'll fight the biggest and most dangerous fires, and tend to be wilderness fires. But more and more, those fires are burning closer to civilization. So
what does it take to do that job? What is the training like? And then when you're doing it, I mean, you've done it. What is the actual work like?
Well, the training is quite intense. And that's because the work is quite intense. So you spend a lot of time hiking to get into the fire's edge, and that means you'll carry a 30 or 40 or 55-pound pack, and you'll hike up steep hills for miles. And then when you get there, you'll be on the fire's edge, and you'll grab your tools, and you'll start cutting line. In effect, it looks like the work of a chain gang. And so some days you'll work 16 hours a day, and you'll do that for 2 weeks straight. And to get ready for that, the beginning of the season is often really intense, I mean, in terms of training. So those, when I was there, we would run 5 or 6 miles in the morning, and then we would do maybe 100 push-ups and 200 sit-ups and a bunch of pull-ups. And then after that, you go out and you cut line, because then, you know, you practice like you work. And so,
what is cutting line?
Cutting line is it's basically removing any flammable vegetation right from the very edge of the fire. And so the idea is that fire, of course, needs fuel to burn. And so when you remove that fuel, the fire stops when it hits that edge.
How wide does the line have to be to stop a fire? I'm sure that depends on the fire.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It depends on the fire. I don't know if you saw in the news this last week, but a bunch of cars were burned up in California when a brush fire crossed a freeway. So that gives you an idea how wide a fire line, you know, has to be to stop a certain type of blaze. So hotshots tend to build fire lines that are, you know, maybe between 6 and 8 feet wide, and then that's actually, it's called clearing it down to mineral soil. So it's actually just dirt. That's what you're after. You're just dry dirt. And then outside of that is a swath that the chainsaws cut. And so that may be 20 to 40 feet wide, and that'll be clear of trees and brush. And so ultimately it looks like a Jeep trail sitting in the middle of a highway. That's maybe a good way to describe it.
So meanwhile, you are doing this when a fire is imminent or when a fire has already started, because you can't just do that work preventively, because you wouldn't know where to do it, because you don't know when a fire is going to start. So here you are, there's a fire, and then here are these guys cutting 8-foot wide lines against time.
It's definitely a race against time. So the fire is often spreading pretty quickly. I mean, but, you know, a lot of times hotshots are able to do their best work at night when it's a little cooler and the humidity is a little higher and the fire behavior is calm. And so they're able to sort of make ground on the fire.
When you clear a fire to bare dirt, that must be incredibly hard work, because you're taking out roots in forests that are not shallow.
Yeah, no, it's hard. It's hard. It is. It's hard. I think that's why the job tends to attract 20 to 30-year-olds. You know, I think most hotshot superintendents don't, you know, they'll retire by the time they're 45. And I don't know of any who have survived a career without any sort of major injuries. A lot of them have back pain or, you know, hurt shoulders or twisted knees, ACL tears, whatever it may be. But you know, they hike hundreds, maybe thousands of miles in really rough terrain every year. And that's what they love. You know, I mean, that's why they keep coming back to the job while all of these things are hard. I mean, the flip side of that is that these guys get to work in the most beautiful places in the country. They just happen to be on fire.
Yeah. I mean, you said a moment ago, it's like a chain gang, and one of the, it's just a detail of the book, but one that I found interesting was sometimes people that are on firefighting crews are actually prison inmates. They're really good workers, and then when they get released from jail, a lot of the time they'll walk right into that job.
Yeah, so that's a program that was started in the late 40s, and so that I think it's a great program. And because the prisoners want that job because it gives them an opportunity to leave prison, and so they'll go out and they get to work fires for the summer, and it's for them, you know, just like it is for kids. It's a great adventure for them, and I think just like it is for a hotshot, I mean, they have to prove themselves capable of doing that work, and the only way to do it is to actually fight the fires. And I think once they've proven themselves capable, the inmates often leave prison and they don't necessarily have a whole lot of opportunities. And a lot of Forest Service crews know that if they've done the work on an inmate crew, then they're also capable of doing the work on the Forest Service crew.
There is quite a lot in the book, which I found fascinating, about the culture of hotshot firefighters, because you're not just always out there doing the work. There's the beginning of the day and the end of the day and the waiting and the, you know, camaraderie and the hazing and the pranks and the kind of pretty serious rough hazing that they do of rookies. Did you experience this yourself?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, to be clear, I think the hazing is, it may not feel like it is, but I do think in general it's coming from a good place. I mean, the idea is that this is a weird thing to defend, but like the idea is that I think most hotshots want to be sure that the man that they're working beside is going to have their back when things get really tough. Whether or not that requires like putting leaves into my sleeping bag and, you know, and crawling into them at night, or whether, you know, like they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't talk to me for 2 weeks, and it's sort of an isolating position to be a rookie on a hotshot crew. But, I do think it has its place. I mean, it's the hotshots tend to believe, like anybody who's serious about their jobs, that they're the best at their jobs, you know. And I think part of that is really believing it, you know, and they believe it.
There's not a lot of women, none in this crew that you're writing about in the book, but there's not a whole lot of women doing this. But there are some. I had a friend who was a hotshot. And rough work, how does it change the dynamic when there's a woman on board?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. There aren't a lot of women who do it. And I think it's because there's so many men who do it. I think that, you know, they tend to get hazed a lot. And, you know, I think that there's also a lot of sexual harassment, and whether, you know, it's like it's a man's world out there, and that's just the truth. And I think the women who do it have to figure out how to cope with that. And a lot of, you know, I had my first fire captain was a woman, and she was really well respected, and she was an excellent firefighter. But, you know, what she used to say is that you're either, this is going to be crass, but you're either a lesbian or you're a slut. And that's how the men on the fire line would treat the women. And so, I don't know if that's changed since the time I was on the line, but you know, I know it was tough for her when she first started out.
And she earned her respect.
Oh, she earned her respect because she was able to A, hang with the men, and then B, I think in many cases she was better, right? She was a better firefighter when it came to tactics or logistics or operations. And now she's moved way up, and she's actually an air attack. So she's an aerial commander. She flies around the fires, and she, coordinates the airplanes and helicopters that are fighting the blazes.
We're talking to Kyle Dickman about his book On the Burning Edge. Firefighters seem to love fire itself. Starting fires, watching fires, putting out fires. Explain to us what that's like.
I mean, it's so dynamic, right? Well, there's two parts of it. I mean, I can't imagine anybody who sits around a campfire and isn't just mesmerized by, you know, the dancing of the flames. But then take that and, you know, scale it up hundreds of times. And there's just something incredible about watching, you know, it's like nature has no ends. It's just the power is unbelievable. And so when you watch an entire, you know, forest burst into flames, it's pretty incredible. The other thing is that the men and women want to fight fire because they spend their summers training for it. And so, you know, you want to put into action what you've been preparing for.
At the same time, there is, and you devote a very important and interesting chapter to this, there are some really poor policies that started getting put in place about 100 years ago, driven actually by the timber industry, that led to the kind of fire suppression that has created ecological havoc, particularly in the dry Southwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where to start? So, yeah, I mean, I think 1910 is basically when we started actively suppressing fires. And we got really good at it by the 1950s. We were suppressing about 98% of blazes before they reached the size of a city block. The consequence of that, I think it's pretty well understood now, but is most western forests were adapted to fire. And in the absence of flames, you had forests grow incredibly thick. So here in New Mexico, for instance, on 1 acre of land, there's 1,300 trees per acre, where a century ago, there was just 150. And so when a fire does start...
Oh my God, it's almost 10 times as much.
Oh, it's incredibly thick. I mean, if you know, you've walked around the forest in Santa Fe Not in the pinyon and juniper so much, but up in the ponderosa, and you can just see it's like where if you have to imagine that used to look quote unquote park like, you know, with grass or low brush, and then these big ponderosa pines. And today it's these big ponderosa pines, and then filled in with, you know, white fir or aspens. And so when a fire does start, it works like a ladder. It can climb up from the bottom and jump up into the middle layer, and then up into the crowns. And once the fire's in the crowns, the trees you can't stop the fire.
And it's also, I mean, the kind of fire to which forests are naturally adapted is healthy for the ecosystem and all the creatures living in it, but the kind of fires that we have now, not so much.
Not so much, yeah. They're burning way too intense. It's much too hot. So look at the Las Conchas fire just outside of Santa Fe in 2011. I mean, much of what burned out there, we're never going to see it return. And I think, you know, that's what's really tragic about the whole thing is because, you know, I love America's forests. You know, I spend every moment that I have in them, and knowing that we've lost this, what once was this beautiful ponderosa forest, and that's never going to return. I think that's actually sort of heartbreaking, and I think that's really what's so important about getting the policies right.
Tell us about the role of the timber industry at the get-go in forming these policies.
Sure. So. Teddy Roosevelt founded the Forest Service in 1905. Congress sets the budgets for all agencies, and Congress was not a huge fan of Teddy Roosevelt, and so what they did is they said, you can't have any money. And so they gave him this really anemic budget. The Rangers used to have to pay for their own horses, their own feed, their own tools. And basically nobody believed the Forest Service was going to survive beyond its infancy. And then in 1910, this fire starts in Idaho, burns 3 million acres of timber, and the timber industry sees every blackened tree as a dollar lost. And so they suddenly felt this, and actually the guys who were fighting that fire were all Forest Service Rangers. And so suddenly the Congress saw a purpose for the Forest Service. They said, these guys can go out and they can stop fire from burning our trees. And the result of that is you had basically a coupling of the Forest Service and the timber industry. And so that lasted up until the 70s and the 80s. And then in the 70s and 80s, you had the rise of the environmental movement, the Endangered Species Act, and you had sort of an awakening among environmentalists about fire's role in the systems. And shortly thereafter, the timber industry collapsed and the Forest Service lands. It's down to like 30% of what it once was at its heyday. But the fire policies never changed. And so firefighters are continuing to suppress all these fires, but the timber, we're no longer thinning the forest. And so the result is that more fuel, hotter fires, more destruction.
It's also kind of an object lesson about what happens, like, okay, the timber industry wants every tree saved for their own profitable purposes, which eventually leads to trees getting so complete, forests getting so burned that there's not a tree left, and will never grow. I mean, it's the
right
opposite of what they wanted in the first place.
Yeah, but you know, I think they probably, by the time that was true, they didn't care because they'd already made their millions. You know, yeah, it is an interesting relationship. But it's not really the case anymore. I mean, I'm actually an advocate of more logging on public lands at this point, because I think you need to see it. I think you need to be responsible logging. We don't want to see a return to the clear-cutting days of the 70s and the 80s, but we do need to be out there, and we need to see more timber harvest from public lands, because otherwise, in the absence of that, you're going to see more fires like Las Conchas. It's more fuel to burn and the rest of it.
Now, in your view, is there a kind of logging that most closely approximates or imitates the effect of a healthy fire?
I think that you have to do it hand in hand. So it's not that logging doesn't that you can't only do logging. You have to do logging, and then you have to thin the forest out and prepare it so that when you do start a fire, or a fire does burn in there, it's not catastrophic. But you have to have both. And, I mean, you know, we've all seen logged landscapes. They tend to be ugly, and it tends to take a long time for that land to recover. And so, but, you know, I do think we need to be seeing both more fire on the landscape and more logging.
Now, the fires that you describe in this book, and we're talking about a wonderful book called On the Burning Edge, these fires are so terrifying. I mean, when trees are burned, this is something I had no idea, when trees are burned on that scale and at that heat, the water from the leaves and from the trees goes into the air, creates its own weather, creates thunderstorms that in their own way become catastrophes, and their people can get caught, and even helicopters can get caught in columns of air that are incredibly dangerous. There's stories and, you know, burning trees sending branches 1,000 feet into the air. Yeah. I mean, it's apocalyptic.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's the power of nature. I mean, some of these things, some of these fires burn like volcanic eruptions. It's just incredible. So, I mean, I think that's also part of the reason that people love the work. It's like you get to go out and watch just this amazing natural phenomena, you know? And yeah, it's destructive, but it's also, it's not, there are fires in the historic record there are instances of fires in the historic record burning just as intensely as we're seeing today, but it was just that they were more they were less common. So now we're seeing a higher frequency of highly destructive blazes, whereas before we saw a higher frequency of low intensity blazes. But you know, if you wonder why fires get so much coverage in the press these days, it's because I can tell you that when Las Conchas started, the first thing I did is I got into my truck, drove to the top of a hill at La Tierra, and I stood out there and I looked out at the fire, and I put my arms out and was like, oh my God, this is a sight. You know, it was really just an incredible thing to witness.
I was driving back from Albuquerque the night that it started, and we didn't know that it had started. On the hill was this, on this sort of light, and we were like, is that Los Alamos? Yeah. Is that, what is, and we realized it was, and it felt like the end of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so primal.
Yeah, oh, it is, and it's fires like that are truly terrifying, you know, truly terrifying, so.
And it's interesting that you say, you know, these are the forces of nature, and yeah, some of these kinds of highly destructive fires did exist in the past, not as often as they do now. And the fact that they happen as often as they do now makes them almost kind of man-made events.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to look at it. You know, I think, you know, we just talked about fire policy, but, you know, we can also, climate change is also there's an element of climate change in there. So we've seen a 1.7 degree increase in temperature since the 1970s. And we're expected to see a 4 to 6 degree increase by the end of this century. And so the idea is that more warmer air holds more moisture than cooler air. And so as the temperature increases, you're going to see that moisture wicked out of the forest. And so it's going to further prime the forest for high intensity fires. So those two things, you know, denser forests, warmer climate, are creating more intense fires. But the reason that it matters is because there are now 140 million people living in fire-prone areas. And so you have to look at fires and say, you know, they're not natural disasters until they burn something that we value. And there are now so many things that we value in the West that there are more fires that are becoming natural disasters. And I think as a result of that, the agencies feel a lot of pressure to treat all fires like they're natural disasters, because you have to prevent these small fires, you have to stop small fires from becoming big fires. And the paradox is every time you do that, you're basically doubling down on a failed policy and creating a larger fire the next time one comes around.
We're talking to Kyle Dickman about his book, On the Burning Edge, A Fateful Fire and the Men Who Fought It. Let's talk a little bit more about policy. There was a part of the book where you talked about studies that have been done about how fires are fought and recommendations for different ways, different methods and practices of fighting fires and managing fires. That knowledge hasn't actually seeped into practice yet. What could we be doing differently?
Ooh. Well, I think I'll start by saying that, yeah, so what we're doing is we're continuing to do the things that we've always done, which is we're really continuing to fight fires really aggressively. I think what it's going to take to change that is actually going to take a cultural shift within the agencies. And so the Forest Service tends to be, the Forest Service right now, 50% of the Forest Service's budget is dedicated to fire. Most of that goes to fire suppression. Most people who are staffed in high level positions in the Forest Service come from fire. And so that, so really, if you look at it, that agency, I mean, it's called the Forest Service, but in many ways it's the fire service. So I think if we're going to see changes in the, Forest Service, it's going to have to start within the agency, and we're going to have to see more people brought into high level positions that aren't necessarily related to fire. So I think basically we want to see a shift of priorities.
What would that mean for? I mean, okay, a fire breaks out. What could or should be done differently?
Well, so there are. Well, I think what we need to do, and actually we're seeing some of this. So I can't remember the name of the fire. Was it Horesco or Arisco or something like that? It was a fire just north of Santa Fe. It was in 2013. It was a huge fire, but they let it burn. So it started in the wilderness, and they didn't send any firefighters on to actually aggressively suppress it. They just sent managers to watch it and make sure that it didn't, you know, burn anything that people valued. So what it's called, so I think what we'll see more of in the future, and I think a good proactive way to deal with fires, is called point protection. So instead of having a fire and putting the entire fire out, you send firefighters to the blaze and you say, look, it's going to burn toward these ranches, or it's going to burn toward Los Alamos or Santa Fe. So what instead of fighting the entire fire, you just protect Santa Fe. Effectively, you create a moat around the town, and you let the fire burn into that moat, sit down, and then burn around it.
There are so many people who have built a lone house in the woods. That's what makes it hard.
Yeah, that's what makes it hard. But I'll be the first to say that. I mean, right now, the way that we treat Forest Service or basically wildland firefighters, it's like a public service. But so we're expected, these homeowners in the wilderness expect the federal government, the state government, county governments to send wildland firefighters out to protect their houses. But I would actually advocate that it's the homeowners' responsibilities to protect their houses, because if they create defensible space beforehand, if they use chainsaws and chippers to thin out the brush around their house, it's no longer the responsibility of the Forest Service or the firefighters protect that house, because in effect that house has already been protected.
One of the things that I thought was interesting in your book was that after a really big fire, people started actually showing up to meetings about fire safety and about how to make those spaces around their house.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. It takes that, and actually, it takes that, I think, on a federal level too. I mean, I was just talking to a former incident commander, a guy who's been fought fires for 40 years, and we were talking about how we're going to change policies, and he said, "I think the only way we're going to change policy is we're going to have to see something in fire the same scale of Katrina." You know, it's like we're going to have to see Denver burn, for instance. And then I think when something like that happens,
God forbid, yeah.
Oh, I know, it'd be terrible. But I think that's sort of attention grabbing event that we're going to need to see.
Yeah. Now let's get back to the book and this whole question of the 19 firefighters who lost their lives, hotshot firefighters, amazing people. You describe each of their lives, and it's a very personal book in the sense that we get to know them and their families and girlfriends and adventures and things that, you know, it's a sort of beautiful memorial to these men. But there are safety procedures and guidelines for firefighters, and one of them involves safety zones. What are safety zones in a wildfire?
Safety zones are places that firefighters can sort of weather a firestorm without having to deploy their fire shelters, these sort of aluminum tents that firefighters use in a last-ditch effort. So they can retreat to a safety zone, and the fire can burn around them, and they won't be burned.
Now, one kind of safety zone is the part of the forest that's already been burned, the charred black of the forest.
That's right, yep.
And so if you retreat into that, it's not going to burn again because it's already been burned. Describe these little aluminum shelters. I couldn't quite visualize them in my mind. They seem really scary.
Well, they're pretty scary. You don't ever want to use them. You really don't want to use them. But they're about, so they sit on the back of your pack, underneath the bottom of the pack, and this sort of bread box size red case. And so you pull, so when you need them, and God forbid you need them, you pull out this shelter, and it's folded in, it's sort of accordioned into this thing, and you rip it out, and you flick it out, and it creates a tent. You know, it's this little aluminum tent. And you crawl under the tent, and the idea is the aluminum will reflect the heat. But they're not designed to withstand direct contact with flame. And they're also, they're not designed to withstand a certain temperature threshold. So, and I can't remember exactly what that is, but what I do know is that in Yarnell they were experiencing temperatures of, in excess of 2,000 degrees. And so those shelters were not, those shelters just completely destroyed. They delaminated, the aluminum melted, chainsaws were just completely destroyed. All the plastic was gone. The only thing left of hand tools was the metal heads. The wood was gone. The radios were destroyed. Everything was sort of melted together into these masses of these horrifying objects.
And at the same time, if in lesser fires or fires where somebody has survived under some of these little aluminum shelters, they can still get to incredibly hot temperatures inside these things and have people survive.
Yeah, they do work. That's why firefighters carry them. But they work, and the idea is that you should, you never want to use them. You want to reach a safety zone like the black before you have to deploy your fire shelter. But in the event that you deploy your fire shelter, you want to be in a place that is far enough away from brush or trees so that the temperatures stay low enough that you can survive.
One of the firefighters survived because he was the lookout. He was able to get to safety. Brendan McDonough, also known as Donut. What was it like for him to be the only surviving member of the Granite Mountain Hotshots?
I think it was absolutely devastating. It's exactly what you would expect. He has this really... he's fighting PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. He's fighting survivor's guilt. But in addition to those two things, he also had this really bizarre experience where he went from one member of 20 on a hotshot crew, basically an anonymous person in the world of the 56,000 wildland firefighters. One day, that was his position on June 29th. On July 1st, he was the face of wildland firefighters, and he was sort of the darling of the nation. And he went, he was on the Today Show, and he was accepting grants or checks for $500,000 from the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he was brought on stage at pop country concerts, and there were girls in spaghetti strap shirts screaming his name, "We love you, Donut." And all of this happened, all of this fame happened because he was the only one who survived when 19 of his closest friend died. And so it really was a perverse dynamic. And his psychologist said, "I don't know how it is that we're going to help you, but we're going to figure it out."
We're talking to Kyle Dickman about the book On the Burning Edge,